Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast Spoilers Specials. This one is dedicated to the first entry in the Dark Universe series, The Mummy. Whoa. Yes, over the next hour or so, we'll be delving deep into the adventures of Tom Cruise as he fights off a lady wrapped in bandages. I don't know, I wasn't really paying attention. And joining me to talk about it is the man who wrote the Empire 3-star review of this movie. Here to explain himself. No, I'm kidding. Dan Jolin, how are you?
Salam alaikum.
What does that mean?
It means hello in Egyptian. Well, oh, Arabic.
You're so good.
Peace be upon you is actually, I believe, what it means.
Yeah, you say it as hello, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Watch.
I love how much you prepared for this. This is great. This is really, really great. I am going to load up Duolingo so I can talk with you in Arabic over the next hour or so. And also hear that you've just heard him. It's James Dyer.
Please call me James Ra, the ever living.
I will not call you that. How are you both?
Good. Good.
Excellent. Looking forward to getting into The Mummy, so to speak, over the next hour or so.
Yes.
Any of you have Freudian issues? This movie did not address them in any way. It's fine.
I did have mummy issues. It can be said.
Yes, we do have mummy issues, and we will be getting into them very, very soon. Very clever. See what I was doing? I set you up.
Yeah. Wrap it up, Chris. Oh, the puns are flowing quick and fast.
But before we delve deep into the mind of Alex Kurtzman, let's hear from the man himself. He is the director of The Mummy. This is only his second directorial effort, but he has been a writer and producer of all sorts of films over the last few years. He's been on the Empire podcast before. Didn't write this one, interestingly enough, or at least isn't credited with a screenplay. That goes to Dylan Cussman, David Kep, and Christopher McQuarrie, but I'm sure many, many other people had a bash at the old keyboard over the gestation period of The Mummy. But here is Alex Kurtzman talking about all sorts of stuff to Helen O'Hara. Not only does he discuss, of course, The Mummy in spoilerific detail, there is some discussion of the future of the Dark Universe as well. So I'm very excited to hear this because I haven't actually heard it myself. So this is going to be fun. We're well prepared, but do enjoy this interview with Alex Kurtzman. I will say again, word to the wise, this is a spoiler special. So if you have not seen The Mummy and you care about the spoilers for this film, do not listen to this interview. Do not go beyond this point. It is cursed. And a great curse will come upon you. Go and watch the film and then come back and listen to it and then listen to us afterwards. Here's Alex Kurtzman. Enjoy.
Okay, so welcome to the Empire Podcast, Alex Kurtzman.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So we're here today to talk about The Mummy. You've been involved in this now for more than 3 years. You were announced as director 3 years ago and you're already attached, isn't that right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, Universal came to me, I guess it's probably been now going on 5 years. And originally I was approached as a producer. And they asked if I would be interested in doing The Mummy, and I jumped at it because I love the Universal monsters. And I was intrigued by the idea of finding a new way to tell the story. Mm. And it took a long time to figure out a new way to tell the story. And the idea of building the larger universe did not exist when this all started. So that kind of evolved as The Mummy evolved.
I was going to ask you that, actually, because, you know, other directors involved in other shared universes have talked about the pressures that can bring and the opportunities mm-hmm. that can bring. Mm-hmm. So I guess because you're there already, you're writing as well as directing, you've mm-hmm. got the chance to kind of weave those in and kind of, I guess, set up the rules for everybody else to play with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for us, definitely there's rules that we're setting up, and we spent a lot of time talking about what the rules were. I think I should start by saying I think that the most important thing for me and for all of us was to say we want to deliver a satisfying mummy movie first and foremost. And if we can do that, and in the context of that, open the door to the larger Dark Universe, then great, you know. And I think that meant not overwhelming the audience with too much information about the rest of the universe, but actually just teasing it and really presenting information to the audience through the point of view of Tom's character, Nick, in that it was relevant to his experience in the film, as opposed to just, here's a lot of stuff that isn't related to the movie. You know, that wasn't how we wanted to approach it. But your question was actually about the pressure of it and how we do it.
Well, how you do it, but also, like, I mean, I guess the pleasures of doing it, what advantages does it give you this time around?
I mean, there were so many amazing things that happened over the course of the 5 years of making this film. And so many surprises. You know, if you told me at the beginning that Tom Cruise was going to be in the movie, I would have said, there's no way, you know. If you told me that we were going to make the movie at the scope and scale that this movie has been made at, I would have not been surprised, but I would have been surprised, you know. I think that what's interesting is that as we evolved The Mummy, we kind of came to the idea that, well, maybe one of the things that makes the story we're telling and makes it different from the other Mummy movies is that The Mummy actually exists in a larger world of gods and monsters. And maybe that's what Tom's character comes to understand over the course of the movie. And the minute that became an idea, suddenly we started thinking about the other monsters and how they would connect to both The Mummy and to the larger world. And, you know, the fun of it is working on developing the world. You know, as a kid, I loved these monsters so much. And I feel like for me, what defines the monster universe and defines the universal monsters very specifically is really a genre unto itself, separate from horror, separate from slasher films, even though there are elements certainly of horror in this, in the world, is that you are scared of the monster, and you feel tremendous sympathy and empathy for the monster. And that means that those films are deep character studies. They all were character studies. And they reflect something so human, ironically, about all of us. Because what do the monsters want? They want to connect. They want to be loved. They want to fit in. And they don't. And they never really will. Because if they did, they wouldn't be monsters anymore. And I think we all feel a version of that, or have felt a version of that. And that's why I think the legacy has endured for almost 100 years now.
I actually went back and watched the 1932 version of The Mummy last night. And I noticed, which I had totally forgotten, you open with the same quote, or mm-hmm. a slightly different mm-hmm. version of the same
yes.
quote.
Yes. So did you see the similarities throughout the film to the Karloff film?
I wanted to ask you to talk about those a little bit. I mean, how much did you sort of go back and look at, you know, specific scenes, specific mm-hmm. lines? Because there were lots of like echoes in the
yes.
dialogue that I heard.
Very consciously. Yeah. That was the movie that I took my real inspiration from. And I just loved that film as a kid. I loved the texture of it, the world creation of it. The Karloff's performance was just so extraordinary in it.
And his eyes are amazing.
His eyes are amazing. And as you see, you know, in the close up, the way they lit his eyes, I just stole those shots in my version. And, you know, I did the same thing with Sophia over and over again.
Yeah. And what about the 99 version, which is another one? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very different film, but I have a huge amount of affection for
me
it.
Me too. Absolutely. And we tip our hat to that as well in the film several times.
I noticed the book.
The book, yeah. Yes, you did. You did notice the book. And obviously The Face in the Sand was a real memorable, you know, moment from the original.
Mm, absolutely.
Or the remake of the original.
The middle version.
The middle version, exactly.
Like the Middle Kingdom. And then tell me about Tom Cruise, because, you know, he's not a guy who'll just come in and act. He has very strong opinions. He knows what his audience wants. He's pretty much always right about what his audience wants, you know, over his career. What did he kind of bring when he came in?
Well, I've worked with Tom now for 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, we started on Mission Impossible 3, and we have very similar sensibilities in terms of what we look for in films and in filmmaking. And we both really share the belief that you've got to bring 100% of yourself. It is an all-in deep dive when you make a film. And it is really all in service of doing one thing and one thing only, which is to deliver to the audience an experience that's different, you know, and original and fresh. And for a guy who's made as many films as Tom has made, to have that be his goal every time he makes a movie is quite something.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have written and produced movies and television, certainly nowhere near at the scope and scale of Tom's work. But this is only my second film as a director, and the first movie I did was much, much smaller.
Yeah.
So to be able to inherit the benefit of all of his knowledge, and, you know, Tom makes this amazing handshake agreement with you and you become partners. You know, you're going to look at every aspect of the filmmaking together. And I learned so much from, you know, the directors that he's worked with just by being able to talk to him about his experience making films and being able to ask him, you know. And honestly, there were times where, because I'm such a lifelong Tom Cruise fan, we would be doing takes and I'd be like, I need Jerry Maguire here. Just give me Jerry Maguire this time. And he would, got it. And he'd go do it. You know, or I'd say Charlie Babbitt and he would go right into Rain Man, you know.
Yeah.
And it's about knowing his work so specifically that I needed a specific flavor or a tone that I knew could be captured by that kind of character, and he would immediately understand how to translate what I was looking for into whatever the line was.
Into this character in this moment.
Yeah.
I mean, Jerry Maguire was one of the things that came to my mind when I saw him, because we haven't often seen this kind of character from Tom Cruise before.
Well, ironically, you know, you've seen it more than you think. You know, his character in Rain Man is a very morally challenged guy who's incredibly selfish and, you know, only out for himself, and comes to discover, you know, his humanity. Vincent in Collateral, Jerry Maguire, you know, Tom, I think, has a unique career in that he has a history of playing characters who are morally challenged. And those are honestly my favorite parts that he plays, because it's very satisfying to watch a character go from as complicated and messed up as he is in those parts to understanding more about themselves. There's more of an arc and an experience you as an audience member have when you watch someone go through that, as opposed to he's just a great guy at the beginning of the film and he ends a great guy, you know? And you know, those movies can work really well too for other reasons, but at the level of pure character, I find the morally challenged guys much more satisfying.
Yeah, well, he certainly goes on a journey in this one. I mean, this is a spoiler podcast. Let me ask about the ending.
Sure.
Was that there from the beginning? Was that something that you, you know, sort of pitched to him almost?
Whenever you make a film, you want to try and be able to distill the character arc down to a simple idea and pitch it in purely emotional terms. And when Tom came on board, we began to rewrite the script pretty heavily. And what emerged in our conversations was this idea. This is the story of a monster of a human being who has to become a literal monster to find his humanity. And that was always there from the beginning.
Right.
And once that became our compass, the story organized itself around that idea.
Interesting. And so one of my colleagues had this theory that he was going to turn out to be like a descendant of Van Helsing or something, and that would be the sort of the linking material between these movies. I mean, it still seems like he could be the one of the links between these movies, but obviously not in that way.
Anything is possible.
We'll spoil one movie, but not the ones to come. Let me then talk about Russell Crowe as well, because I'm guessing that's, again, if you were doing the low budget version of this, you would not have Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe in this movie.
No.
So that's got to have been a pleasure.
Such a pleasure. I mean, you know, a lifelong fan of Russell Crowe's, a lifelong fan of Tom Cruise's. One of my first jobs, my first job out of college, I was a PA on Heat, Michael Mann's Heat. And I remember the feeling, you know, we shot scenes with Pacino and we shot scenes with De Niro, but there were two scenes where they were together in the whole film, three actually. And every time they were together, there was this buzz of anticipation on the crew because they wanted to see what was going to happen. And it was so odd, however many years later, to be directing a movie with two equivalent stars and feel the same buzz of excitement and to be able to, you know, not only direct them, but to get along so well with them. And they're both so attuned to character. And we spent time rehearsing and talking about the scenes in advance and what we wanted to get out of them. And they, you know, all your rehearsal time with actors tends to be a time in which you are building real deep bonds of trust, because once that trust is there, then you get on set and you start throwing stuff out there and you want to create a space for the actors to feel as safe and free as possible, to be vulnerable and to deliver the performance they need to deliver. And then sometimes your job as a director is literally just to stand back and do nothing because you've got actors like Tom Cruise and Russell Crowe, you know? And I enjoyed so much the process of working with them. The fight was a lot of fun to shoot because they're both very experienced in fight choreography, and they both knew that the only way to do a fight like that was to actually really go for it. So when they're throwing punches at each other, but they're so experienced that they know they can miss the nose by half an inch, you know? And it was just an absolute delight, you know, a real delight. And I think a director's dream to work with guys like that.
And how did you decide on Jekyll?
There was a lot of debate about whether or not to put Henry in the movie, because what I don't tend to respond to as an audience member is, you know, seeing a movie where 50 characters are thrown into the pot right at the beginning and I haven't really established relationships to them. And I, in the spirit of wanting to make this a satisfying mummy movie, it wasn't intuitive that Henry Jekyll would be in the film. But this is a movie about a guy who in Tom's character, Nick, you know, has good and evil inside of him, has to decide which side of the line he's going to be. A monster could emerge from him at any moment. He's trying to control it. Well, I can now be describing Henry Jekyll to you, you know, and once it became clear that when Nick entered this larger world, he needed a guide through it. And Jekyll has been where Nick is going, and he acts as a mirror to Tom. And so I think that we felt after much debate that we had a justifiable story reason to put him in the film. And it wasn't just about, hey, let's put these two characters together because it'd be cool. But in fact, we needed one to tell the story.
It also gives you, and again, this may be getting too far ahead, but it gives you a big name to carry forward through the Stark universe.
You know, Henry will be, you know, obviously he's the head of Prodigium and a massive organizing principle around what Prodigium is and what they're doing. And you know, obviously having Russell be that guy is very exciting.
And how much did you develop Prodigium themselves? Because, I mean, we get tantalizing hints more than anything else. They're sort of, at first I was like, they're paramilitary archaeologists. This is weird. And you know, but there is an element obviously of study and of analysis there as well.
Paramilitary archaeologist is a great way of putting it, but you know, that also includes deep, there are scientists. I mean, you know, what I love David Cronenberg films, and one of the things I think is so interesting about Cronenberg is how he will take science and apply it to, you know, horror or mystical things. And you know, you could say the same about Jurassic, you know. And I like the idea that in thinking about doing a modern monster movie, you know, how would modern science deal with a monster? You know, how would they analyze it? And actually in drafts of the script, and in some ways I almost regret not putting it in the movie, there was a lot more time spent on the scientific analysis of what was going on in Aminet's body when she was chained up there.
Oh, interesting.
And they were analyzing, like, she's got seven different types of DNA. Why? Because she fed on seven people. You know, she's got a bunch of different blood in her system. Why? Because she fed on seven different people. You know, she's not, she seems to have a heartbeat, but she's not exhaling oxygen. Why? You know, so there was a lot of really cool stuff in there that ultimately didn't make the cut because it kind of took you away from the story. But that's the kind of stuff that I could get lost in. I just love that stuff.
And you can always like pick bits of that up again and you know, in the future. I wanted to ask about some of the stuff that we see as we're going into the Prodigium. We're passing through the sort of all those formaldehyde jars basically, and there was definitely one with extremely long teeth. What else should people be looking out for in that scene?
There's something right before it.
There was, and I remember spotting it when I was in the cinema, and then I came to write it down. I couldn't remember what it was.
Yes, it's a hand that looks suspiciously like the hand from the creature from the Black Lagoon.
That was it. I spotted the webbing, and I'm like, interesting.
Did you notice? Oh, you did notice the other Easter egg from the Fraser mummy.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the book as well. But no, I thought that was really cool. I was the only thing that I couldn't quite get at first, and I actually watched the making of or one of the featurettes last night, was I couldn't remember if I was so busy looking at the teeth, I didn't notice if it was a wolfy looking skull or a humany looking skull. So I had to go back and check that.
That's a great question, actually. That's a great question.
Either, right?
It could have theoretically been either. It was intended to be a vampire skull.
Right. Okay. So I'm pretty much through most of what I wanted to ask. I wanted to ask about just Aminet herself, I guess. She's got the sort of the tattoos or the brands all over her. Did you have a sort of a theory of what all those said?
Yes. So first and foremost, I wanted to pay tribute to the look of the original mummy. And even though Karloff was only in the bandages for less than 2 minutes of screen time at the beginning of the film, that is what you remember about the mummy. And so I thought, I did not want to put the mummy in a dress or something, you know, it didn't feel appropriate. The bandages are what make the mummy the mummy. So that was first and foremost. Then the idea of her skin regenerating is something that obviously comes from other mummy movies. The runes themselves came from, I studied different cultures and different, everything from tribal markings to, you know, tattooing. And actually the ancient Egyptians did quite a bit of both. And the idea was that when she makes a pact with Set, who's the Egyptian god of death, aka the devil, he kind of brands her and marks her. So those runes were designed by Lizzie and Bella Giorgio, who were our makeup designers, who were brilliant. And it's not actually a language, but the intention was it's a demonic language.
Right. So it's a dedication to him.
It's a dedication to him,
And the other thing that people have been asking about, I guess, which is a nice way to finish, we had this amazing female monster here. And even on Bride of Frankenstein is the next one, which a lot of people have been going, well, why not Frankenstein first? So why not Frankenstein first? Why Bride?
Well, there's a lot of assumptions in that question. How do you know Frankenstein won't be in the movie?
Oh, no, I mean... I should say Frankenstein's monster.
Yeah, well, how do you know Frankenstein's monster won't be in the movie?
Oh, no, I mean, presumably we do. If it's
obviously from
them,
Bride of Frankenstein. I love the Bride of Frankenstein, and weirdly like the original Mummy. Bride of Frankenstein is one of the weirder movies ever made. You know, it's a very strange film. And at the end of the film, Bride shows up and she's on screen for less than 10 minutes and she doesn't say anything. And she rejects Frankenstein utterly. And he's so upset, he pulls a lever and she blows up. And that's the whole movie. And yet people still remember her.
But she has that hair.
The hair. Exactly. It's iconic. And I think there's something so mysterious about her and the idea that she is a woman designed for a man who rejects the man. That is an amazing idea, especially for an idea for the time. And there's a lot you can extrapolate from that, and there's a lot to be built into it. So like the Mummy, there will be homages and you know, I think we want to give our reverence to that film because it's a wonderful, wonderful film, and build on the ideas that it sort of silently gave us back in the day.
Awesome. Well, we look forward to it. Well, Alex Kurtzman, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
Okay, so that was Alex Kurtzman talking to Helen O'Hara. Fascinating interview. I loved every second of that. It was really, really great. And now here to talk about the prodigiums and the condigiums of The Mummy. It's me, James, and Dan. First of all, as a bit of a scene setter, we do have some questions from Twitter. Some of them, I have to say, are of the why variety. But where do we stand in this film? Dan, you gave this film 3 stars, which we always say is a recommendation on on the podcast. Why?
Explain myself. It's all in the review, is there? No, I mean, look, it's...
Don't read, you know that.
It's funny when you see these films and then you see the reaction afterwards.
He's backpedaling already. Look at him.
I'm not backpedaling. It's cultural commentary. It's not backpedaling. It's forward-looking into culture. But it's kind of, you see this film, and I saw it with, you know, completely free of prejudice, and I went, well, that was fun, wasn't it? A bit hokey, a bit silly. I do say this in my review, some of it's daft, some of it doesn't make sense, some of it's a bit annoying, not keen on the CG animals. I didn't say that in my review, but that is true.
Oh, you CG animalist.
But I thought if I went out on a Friday or Saturday night, I would come home and I'd go, oh, that was quite fun. And then you just see, you know, Bad review. People lay into it. Everyone hates it. All of a sudden, everyone hates it. I mean, look. Hang on. Here's an example, right?
Don't you shush me on my podcast. No. Don't you shush me on my podcast.
Are you about to
hush? Hush, my darling. So, Gail Simone, right? Gail Simone, Wonder Woman writer on Twitter.
Yep.
This is great. So the Mummy is like gluing a bunch of smoke alarms to your head while your ugly cousin. whacks them with a wooden axe handle. Okay. This isn't her only tweet on it. The Mummy is that one-night gallery where a naked Sean Hannity finally comes out the other ear, but oh no, he laid wet eggs in your brain. I didn't get that one.
Thank you for reading it out.
The Mummy is like your best childhood Saturday morning, except the cartoon is Scrappy-Doo and the cereal is Steve Bannon Toast Crunch.
Oh no! Are you reading these out because you are regretting not putting those into your review?
I'm reading these out because, I mean, they're very funny and I recommend them, but I'm just like, I don't get what is so egregious and so offensive about
this
film.
I will say off the bat, I don't hate this movie. I feel that this movie has been designated as the pinata of the summer by this strange, shadowy cabal of critics, especially on the other side of the water, who are giving it... What's his Rotten Tomatoes score at the...
Metacritic is 34.
34. Mm. And what's his Rotten Tomatoes, do you know?
No, I'd have to Google
it. We'd have to Google that. But it's low, right? It's low. In fact, I can get that in the blink of an eye, thanks to the magic of Wi-Fi. 17%. 17%. That's less than 1 star. That's less than an average of 1 star, if you, you know, work it out on the Rotten Tomatoes scale. It is not that. It is not Batman and Robin. It is not horrendously awful. In fact, I thought the first 25 minutes showed real promise. There were some interesting little wrinkles and quirks and twists maybe that I didn't see coming, and I quite liked the fact that the cruiser was playing a character that wasn't atypically cruisy, although, you know, I think he's making more of a point of playing against type when he's not playing Ethan Hunt. He's playing, you know, he's an America Made or Edge of Tomorrow where he's a coward, and I thought this guy was new and different as well. And then it just turned into a bit of a muddled, murky, shapeless mess in the second half for me. That largely coincides with the introduction of Edward Hyde and his alter ego, Dr. Henry Jekyll. But we'll get into that. We'll get into that in a second. But I don't think it's a 3-star film. But neither do I think it's a 1-star monstrosity, which is certainly what a lot of critics seem to think. But hey ho, that's just my opinion. Jimbo.
I wasn't a fan. I never thought I'd be sitting in a cinema channeling my willpower and begging Arnold Vosloo to appear, but I was.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of those Mummy films, Mummy Returns, Dragon Emperor, all that jazz.
What about Scorpion King?
Or indeed, actually, do you know what? I don't mind Scorpion King, but it is terrible. What? It's a long story.
Oh, my God.
I saw it and I enjoyed it when I saw it. Don't worry about it. Mainly because I met The Rock right afterwards. It's a whole thing. Anyway, I'm not a big fan of those, but they are significantly better, I thought, than this, which was... My issues with this are there are a lot of films out there that are very cynical, and God knows DC have made a lot of them, but this was the most cynical film because it felt a little bit like there was a boardroom at Universal Towers where they said, you know what, we don't have a superhero franchise. And someone said, well, we've got Fast and Furious. And someone said, shut up. And so they said, we need a superhero franchise. What can we do? They said, well, we've got a horror franchise. What if we took this horror franchise and squeezed it through the superhero origin filter? What could we come up with? And you have this, which is a super horror hero origin story. And it's what happens if DC made a horror movie. And it's an exercise in box tickery. And Dan, you're raising your hand as if you wish to interject and contradict me. Go for it.
I think there's a lot in what you're saying, but yeah. I quite like that. I quite like the idea of a kind of the monsters of the classic monsters sort of almost being treated like superhero characters in a way that will have their own films and come together and do stuff. I mean, it's not without precedent. They do tend to overlap in the, you know, in the classic films.
But a shared,
you know,
universe,
with Abbott and Costello.
A shared universe isn't actually what I object to. Like sharing these, you know what, that's fine. That's not a problem. It's that it is so transparently a superhero origin film, in particular. I mean, specifically the ending, where you even have the music, the tone, the voiceover, the little epilogue, all of it feels like the setup to he's now out there, they will call on him when he is needed, and it's just like he will never be needed, just fuck off.
I am kind of disappointed that towards the end there wasn't a scene where he turned to Sophia Boutella and said, I'm the mummy now.
Who's your mummy? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think had they cast anyone except Tom Cruise in that role, the film would not work. I think he carries it on pure charisma a lot of the times when you would otherwise lose it. I really enjoyed his performance. Mm-hmm. I thought he was a lot of fun. It's a problematic character and he does breathe life into it. I thought Annabelle Wallace, who's actually very good in things like Peaky Blinders, had nothing to do. All she seems to do is say, Nick, in a variety of pitches.
He said to me, if it was a dialogue drinking game where you had to take a shot every time she said the word Nick.
Yeah, you'd be dead halfway through the film.
You would need Tom Cruise to revive you.
It's a very symbolic name, though. Think about it. His first name's Nick. What he does is he steals loot from tombs. He nicks it, right? His surname's Morton, okay? Uh-huh. Right? Early on in the film, he dies and comes back from the dead. Mort is Latin for dead, right? Hey, and he's on it.
I'd say you maybe give them more credit than they're due, but that actually does make a kind of sense.
All right, then, Nick Morton, he steals the dead. How about that?
He steals from the dead.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's a clever name.
That is, it's a very clever name. Annabelle Wallace doesn't get a lot to do in this. You're absolutely right, especially when you compare it to previous mummies, past. But I quite liked some of the little notes she was trying to go for to avoid becoming a scream queen. I will say, sometimes for spoiler specials, we see the films 2 or 3 times before we get into the Ruth and we talk about it. So we're immersed in every detail and we can recall lines and things that happen. I think we've all just seen the film once.
And I remember almost nothing.
I took copious notes.
Oh, good, Dan.
Copious.
Very, very good. But there's a bit in the church, I think, where she walks in and he's about to be killed, I guess, by the mummy. And she goes, ooh. She does a little kind of wibble. And she does that again later on. There's a little bit of like, ooh, kind of, which I thought was a little interesting note. You know, she's funny, Annabelle Wallace. She's funny in Grimsby. Yes! Grimsby's funny. I'm saying it here, but So I thought that was interesting. And Cruz, I think you're absolutely right. And Cruz, talk about the film being a piñata. Cruz is the human piñata for this film. It just feels like this, like, time to get him. Time to get him. We must take down Tom Cruise. The number of articles and features I've seen about Cruz, and is he a fading star? Is he a man who only has one franchise and then the rest are just pot shots to try and keep a star alive? And there's a certain credence to that, I would say. Definitely, he does not want to go, you know, quietly into the night. He doesn't want to no longer be the you know, the most famous actor in the world. But I think this is an interesting choice. If you look at it from his point of view, he gets to headline potentially a new franchise, potentially a new shared universe. And he attacks it with the usual Cruisian brio, I think. Nothing wrong with him in this film, I would say.
He is the Robert Downey Jr. of the Dark Universe.
He is. He might be 10 years too old for it, but the thing is, Tom Cruise is 52, 53, and he don't look it. I mean, yeah. If I look like it when I'm 52 or 53, I'll be doing very, very well indeed. You know, the man still got it. He looks 40s. Mm. I'll grant him that. You know, he's no longer the ageless Tom Cruise, but it's not like he's Roger Moore in A Few to a Kill, creaking up the Eiffel Tower. He's not like that, is he?
No, he's not, no. And I enjoyed him in this film, to be honest. I mean, go on, James.
I want you to explain something to me, Dan. As our resident mummy expert.
Okay. When a man beats a leaf.
We've covered this on a previous podcast. I understand how reproduction works. What I want to ask you is this. Amunet is having a bad day because her daddy, the pharaoh, has a son. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
So she makes a deal with Set, the god of death.
Mm-hmm.
For what exactly? Some tattoos and piercings, apparently. Because she doesn't get anything special, because all she does is go and slit their throats with a knife that she already had. So what exactly does he give her to help her get vengeance and her throne when she does it all herself?
He gives her the knife.
Oh, so he lent her a knife?
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
He appears...
So she couldn't have procured a knife elsewhere.
He appeared. Well, this is a special knife, isn't it?
It's a special knife. She just slits people's throats. She had solved her own problem before he even got involved.
It's a special knife with a jewel of MacGuffin. And presumably, he gives her the power to have other people turn a blind eye, so she can flit in and out of rooms.
You just made that up.
And also, when she
lives in the palace, she's his daughter. She can go where she likes. She could have killed them all in their sleep anyway, and done away with all of this immortal nonsense.
Clearly, he gives her some power.
He gives her tattoos.
He doesn't give her tattoos.
He gives her
power enough, although we don't necessarily see it.
She has no power.
To make sure that Auto Glass Repair, Auto Glass Replace have a field day later on in London. Because she blows up all the windows, doesn't she?
She does. And I couldn't work out whether... Is that supposed to be because glass is actually made of sand? Was that like a clever chemistry reference?
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't work out whether it was just dramatic or they were like, oh yeah, that's true, that is where it comes from.
Yeah.
But you still haven't answered my question.
She did a deal with the devil. Right?
Yes.
She wanted power.
And
okay?
She'd
been denied power.
Mm-hmm.
So she thought, well, right, I'm going to go on better than that. I'm going to rule the world.
But she would have been fairess without the powers. It's possible I'm labouring this point. We should just move on. It doesn't make any sense. Let's just ignore it.
Well, actually, that whole... I will say this as, you know, the guy who gave it 3 stars.
that's going to be on your tombstone.
I've given worse films higher star ratings.
I think we've all had worse. We've all done worse.
Dude, Chris, tell us how.
No, let's not go there. Honestly, I'm so bored of hearing about his 5-star review of Attack of the Clones.
I'm not.
Okay. That whole thing, though, I thought that whole prologue, they should have cut it. They shouldn't have done it at all. I thought the film would have been easily 10% better had they not had
10%.
That. Easily 10%. Easily. Maybe 12. 12
okay.
and a half. 12 and a half.
Percentage-wise, that would still be 3 stars.
Anyway, whatever. It would have been a solid 3 stars. But it really kind of like, they could have told that story through the revelations that you know, Nick and Jenny and the things that they find out. Mm-hmm. They would have told the story as they went along and had a sense of mystery at the start about what they were finding in this mysterious Egyptian tomb in Iraq.
Well, I have a feeling, I don't know this for sure, of course, but I have a feeling that was either a late edition or studio mandated, as indeed I think the dreadful dialogue at the end of the movie, that awful voiceover, he is a man, but also a monster, and all that nonsense.
I was waiting for them to shine the mummy symbol in the sky at that point.
But the beginning, you know, when they bring Dr. Jekyll into it, and you're, And then they bring him into the again halfway through, and you think, well, that's meant to be his introduction, clearly, when they arrive at Prodigium and he turns up, and that's meant to be the first time we see him, isn't it? And then someone probably watched it, some test screening, and they went, we don't understand what's happening. We honestly, what the hell is happening? And so they had to probably, just a complete guess, no idea. But I'm guessing that they then went back and they re-added, maybe they moved the bit with Sofia Boutella going around killing babies and stuff. It's always a good way to start your film, isn't it? And then, you know, and they maybe moved that forward. And then maybe they brought Russell Crowe in for a reshoot. And meant, stand here, look mysterious. And then hand that bloke a piece of paper. And then don't do anything for the rest of the movie.
Mentioning Russell Crowe, can we speak about the Prodigium experience for a minute? First of all, they lock her up. Thank you, Dan.
Very good. That's a 90s rave reference. I like it.
I thought you would.
James, it's almost like you were human once.
Almost.
Yeah.
So they lock her up and they stick her in a room with the elite special forces of Prodigium, to wit, four IT bods all facing in the opposite direction. Okay.
And don't then speak ill of Pete. Do not speak ill of Pete. That man gave his life.
And then you've got the guy in charge who turns into a psychotic cockney monster when he doesn't get his medication, which he apparently keeps across the other side of the room and just strolls lackadaisically over to it while having a conversation, pausing to fill in some exposition while casually loading it up. Where's his EpiPen strapped to his leg? I mean, admittedly,
you do have to call into question the HR practices of Prodigium. Is this the best they could do to be their leader? A man who's like, you know, who's going to like be like Jack Douglas and carry on every 5 minutes. Way! And off he goes. Oh, he's having another episode. Well, I guess we better lock him in his office then with all those smashable, fragile objects.
It's your old mate, Eddie Hyde. I mean,
I'm better now. You better let me up, mate. I mean,
yeah, it's totally unrealistic to have people who are unsuitable in positions of power, isn't it? I mean, when does that ever happen in the real world? I can't think of
any
examples.
Social commentary.
Yeah, but Dan, too many bad choices in movies these days can be explained away as, oh, it's a Trump reference.
Actually, I was talking about Theresa May.
Moving on.
But I think you're right. I mean, it's ridiculous. He has this condition, and why doesn't he have like a nurse with him to administer the
well, they got the special
the
lockdown
remedy.
They got the lockdown facility thing,
the incredibly slow moving lockdown.
Yeah.
Which enables her to get out and then come back in again in the time it takes.
I mean, what does it say about class as well? I mean, I know that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde were always been conceived as a sort of take on class within society, but what does it say about them that they're so scared of a cockney that they have to lock him in? I mean, I've worked with cockneys. They're perfect. They're people like you and us.
I tell you something, a cockney loves a lock-in.
Oh, this has gone off the rails early.
I mean, Prodigium, James, you were saying, what is it about Prodigium, the shield of this franchise, the wannabe shield of this franchise?
Yeah, they're not the most confidence-inspiring organisation, are they?
But they've got a Gilman hand in a jar.
Well, yes, they do have that.
And a Dracula skull.
The problem is that obviously Hyde is going to resurface quite visibly in the future if the Dark Universe is to proceed. And if anything, this film kind of makes you want to never, ever see that, because he is one of the worst things in this film, which is slightly problematic. I thought Johnny Depp was excellent in this film as the Invisible Man. You might have missed him.
Oh, come on, man. Come on, that's my joke.
Sorry.
Unbelievable
Chris.
Prick.
I should have realised the really obvious first base gag.
Oh, God, no, I tweeted it after the screening. Because
I read your tweets.
Well,
you know, it's problematic. Lost. But let's talk about the Dark Universe for a minute. So they have their new Dark Universe logo at the beginning, an act of hubris / confidence, depending on your point of view.
Yeah.
And this is the first of a franchise. And the next one is Bride of Frankenstein?
Bride of Frankenstein.
Which is an unusual direction.
Yeah. Bride of Frankenstein starring, we presume, we don't know who the bride is yet, but I think they're talking about Angelina Jolie. I imagine she will not.
Maybe they'll cast a man as the bride.
Maybe they will, Dan. Maybe they will. And Javier Bardem, who is a man, as we all know, who does not phone it in for blockbusters, is going to be Frankenstein's monster. So I'm excited about that, and I'm sure you guys are too. But Bill Condon is the director, and that is something at least. And he is a man who is, you know, he knows his way around the Universal Monsters. He knows his way around Frankenstein, or Bride of Frankenstein, of course. Mm-hmm. He directed Gods and Monsters. So,
which is referred to at the beginning of this film.
Indeed,
it is.
Yeah. A new world of.
A new world of gods and monsters. Oh, Eddie Hyde!
That's quite good. That's quite good. That's one of your better impressions.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I was Tom Cruise. Was it good?
It was.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, if you give me approval. Should we take some questions?
Let's do it. The madness consume us all.
Let's take some questions, because if we talk about this movie, can I just say one thing before we take some questions?
No.
This movie has one of the great supporting characters in cinema history, and that is Alan. And Alan is one of the paramedics who attends the crash site and then gets mummified by Sofia Boutella. And he is given a character name within the movie, but not in the credits. And he is played by Stephen Thompson or James Arama. I've no idea which is which, but I think Alan speaks to us all. He is an innocent bystander who is sucked into a maelstrom that he has no idea what is happening. It's a bit political again, isn't it, Dan? Mm. And then he gets mummified and then turned into an evil vessel.
In many ways, we are all Alan.
We are all Alan. And I think I cried a little bit when Alan got killed for the second time, definitively this time.
They should do a Dark Universe one-shot about him.
They should. I would genuinely love to see that. He teams up with Pete, the IT guy who gets possessed, and frees Aminette.
It's like a Dark Universe bringing out the dead.
It would be like, you know the way Coulson was one of the early bridging devices for the MCU, and then obviously he got his own TV show.
You mean Alan, Agent Casper?
Who?
Agent Casper from the West Wing.
Yes, I mean Agent Casper from the West Wing, yes. Alan could be that for the Dark Universe. But anyway, I digress. Questions. This one comes from Mrs. Pancakes. Not her real name, I guess. Assuming they're still going through the Dark Universe, box office II. Yes, this is the thing, because the movie hasn't done that well in the States, did pretty well internationally. Who would you cast as the Wolfman if they include him in future movies?
Oh, that's a good question. Benicio del Toro, no.
Well, that's the thing, because they've
bringing back.
They've tried to set up this Dark Universe. I'm sure they weren't calling it back then. They've tried to set it up twice in the last few years, because obviously Universal holds the IP. Well, it doesn't hold the IP, but it has a long history going back with the Universal monsters. You know, Dracula, Frankenstein, Creature from the Black Lagoon,
Franklinstein,
the Invisible Man, all those groovy creatures, and it's sitting on what it thinks is a financial, it's a gold mine. And it's tried over the last few years to revive them with Benicio del Toro and the Wolfman. That didn't really work. Luke Evans and Dracula Untold, that really didn't work. And now this. So I don't know. But will the Wolfman come back? The Rock's been linked, I believe.
Luke Evans does punch an army with a fist made of bats, and you don't see that every day. Hmm. Just saying.
Chris Pratt, he's not doing anything else.
He has no other franchises.
No other franchises. Let's give him a new franchise. Let's give him a franchise.
Chris Pratt should play everyone in everything. Mm.
I don't think he would be a good Wolfman.
No?
I don't think he'd be a good Larry Talbot, no. Mm.
I don't think it matters who plays the Wolfman, as long as both Jason Bateman and Michael J. Fox cameo.
And there Jack Nicholson.
Yes, Wolf. I like Wolf.
That's a good film.
I genuinely like it.
It's about the male condition, about testosterone and workplace insecurity.
And homophobia, when Ompuri asks him to bite him because he can't transform him with his passion.
That's right. Mm. Good film.
Trampology asks, it's a bold move editing up a Dark Universe title clip. Yes, it is. While I had fun watching it, I'm not particularly invested in a full-on cinematic universe. Do you think the film's pretty overwhelmingly negative reception will have an effect on those future plans? So we know we're getting Bride of Frankenstein unless this movie falls off a cliff and they pull the plug. Because, they can still do that.
I mean, they've had group shots. They've probably got stationery made. It's a whole thing now.
Yeah.
I think they'll do Bride of Frankenstein one. And if that dies on its arse, then all of the other stuff will get quietly shelved.
I don't tend to look very closely at numbers and follow box office a hell of a lot. But didn't this do really well in China?
Yeah, it did pretty well around the world this opening weekend.
Right.
Cruise's biggest ever worldwide opening, apparently. But it did not very well at all in the States. Now, of course, that's no longer the be-all and end-all with box office. Mm-hmm. The most recent Transformers movie, not the one that's about to come out, but Age of Extinction. The only reason that got over the $1 billion line, of course, was because it was huge in China. And so if this, buoyed by the, because it's not going to get anywhere close to $100 million in the States. So if it makes $300 to $400 million worldwide at the rest of the global market, then I think they'll probably take this one as a tentative win and maybe push ahead with their plans. But they've been pretty aggressive with the announcements over the last few weeks, even though the word in this was not great. You could see the trailers weren't great. There was a sense that maybe this one wasn't going to be a winner. And the tracking wasn't that good either at the box office. But they were still pretty aggressive. They were aggressive with announcing Bride of Frankenstein, as James says. That picture of Johnny Depp and Cruise and Javier Bardem and Sofia Boutella and Russell Crowe, none of whom were in the same room, apparently. You know, they were aggressive with potential announcements for the likes of Creature from the Black Lagoon and The Invisible Man and all sorts. So, I don't know. I wonder if they might dial it back a little bit. The same way that, for example, the reinvigorated Ghostbusters franchise never really caught fire. I don't know whether that's still going over there at Sony, the Ghost Core that Ivan Reitman and Dan Aykroyd were working on, that had multiple Ghostbusters movies in the pipeline.
I was at Sony quite recently, and the building's still there.
What, the building with the Ghostbusters sign outside?
Yeah.
Maybe it's still going then.
Yeah.
Maybe
so
they're
the
still...
The building's there, and it's got XO1 outside the front and everything. So.
Well, maybe they're still chipping away.
Mm.
That'd be good. Well done. Well done, then. But I don't know. I'm not burning up to see any more of these movies. I was intrigued at one point. We were talking about this in the podcast a few months ago about how Cruise might fit into future plans. We had there was this theory floating around that he might turn out to be Van Helsing, or he might be in some way the thing that links all the movies together. And I still think he will be that. I still think that he'll probably show up in Bride of Frankenstein. He'll probably show up in some of the other ones as well. But I don't know.
You know who I'd cast as Van Helsing?
Who would you cast as Van Helsing, Dan?
Hugh Jackman. He'd be brilliant.
Maybe change his name from Abraham, though, to something younger, like Gabriel.
Maybe have him turn into a werewolf. Do that.
So he can kill a Dracula.
A Dracula, absolutely. Beetle Dave asks, did all of you play Tom Cruise Bingo? Run a lot? Bingo. Have a shouty bit? Bingo. Wear platforms to make him look taller? Bingo. Apparently you can see this in the first few minutes. Oh, come on. Have the camera angle to make him look the same size as everyone else? Bingo. That's harsh.
This is
Tom Cruise.
Question.
Tom Cruise is the same size as me, and I'm not small. I'm average. Has he got a scene where he can rub his forehead whilst looking worried? I had to wait until the very end, but bingo. Full house. No, I've never played. I didn't even know this game existed.
Leave poor Tommy Cruise alone.
Yeah.
I think there's a scene where he kind of puts his sort of fingertips on his temples and sort of shakes his hands a bit and then pushes his hands out in front of his face.
I'm not on board with all this Cruise hating. I like Tom Cruise. I think he's great.
So is there more to that?
No, that's it. That is my statement. I'm sticking by it.
I should say that Tom Cruise is standing right behind James with a gun pointed to his head at the moment.
True.
And making you read it off a piece of paper. Is that right?
Yeah. I also loved him in Interview with the Vampire. So
yeah. You
know. So at the end, I think he's the idea, isn't it? Because he's taken the God of Death's power into him.
Yeah, this doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
No. My understanding of the story was that the Chosen One would be the vessel and Set would take them over. Two problems there. A, that doesn't happen. He just gets all Set's powers, which seems a bit weird. And B, why was he the Chosen One? Because he just happened to be the nearest bloke when she got woken up.
No, he freed her. He made the conscious choice to free her. She even says it in dialogue, James.
That's
Pay
quite
attention.
Shitty criteria, though, isn't it?
Well, yeah. But it's a set of rules that we're not really told, we're not explained at any point. A lot of people have asked, is he dead or is he not dead? I mean, he's on a plane that crashes and he is unsecured at the point it crashes. There'd be bits of him everywhere.
And then he wakes up in a body bag.
He wakes up in one piece in the body bag.
Yeah.
And the movie's never
because
quite...
Because magic.
Now, the movie's never quite clear whether he is unkillable at that point. After that, because the curse won't let him be killed. But here's another thing.
I didn't get that bit.
Why doesn't he just come back as a corpse like Jake Johnson does? His great turn as Tom Cruise's best mate, Griffin Dunn from In America, Werewolf from London.
But he doesn't actually come back. Isn't he just a vision? Like Griffin Dunn from American Werewolf in London?
Well, obviously he doesn't physically come back, but he's around. So why doesn't Tom Cruise do that? Yeah. Then again, he wouldn't be a physical vessel for Set to come through. Ah, clever, Dan. Well done.
What did I do?
You guided me to a moment of elucidation.
Oh, excellent.
So that was good.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It doesn't make any sense. So at the end, he chooses to take his own life. So is he gambling that he will be able to, by doing that, by choosing to take his own life, that he will somehow have control over Set?
I think so.
There has been no evidence to suggest that will be the case. None.
Yeah.
It's like if I was playing a kind of Universal Horror role-playing game, right? That's what I would have done. That would have really confused the dungeon master.
What, you would take your own life?
Yeah, I would go, actually, do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stab myself with the magic knife, and yeah. I'm going to get the power. I'm going to become a new superhero. And the dungeon master would go, I don't know what to do with that. I didn't prepare for this. Fine, whatever. You're the new superhero.
Well, 2d12, Dan is dead.
And then he comes back from the dead. He comes back, so he kills himself. Set takes over his body, which, don't forget, this is what Amunet wants to happen.
But it's really just a setup for the sequel.
There we go. But then he's in charge of Set at this point, but Set keeps coming through, which is why he growls a bit and goes, oh, leave me alone, I'm all tortured and evil. But he has enough good within him to be able to bring Annabelle Wallace back from the dead, because obviously he's so in love with Annabelle Wallace that he can't live life without her, even though he then chooses to be without her.
And hang out with his mate.
His annoying mate. Thanks. What's the line that someone wrote an article about that was so intense by this line at the end? Thanks for bringing me back from the dead, dude. Which is what...
Yeah.
That character, I can't even remember his name, says to Tom Cruise.
Vale.
He must have a... Yeah. It's a bad line. The whole end of the movie feels to me, once again, like the studio stepped in and went, people aren't getting it. People do not understand what is happening here. So you're going to have Dr. Jekyll or Eddie Hyde. It really doesn't matter. Whatever accent Russ feels like doing on the day. Just explain to the audience what is happening. He's a man and a monster. Oh, yeah. You know, it just feels a bit on the nose. Thanks for bringing me back from the dead, dude.
Yep. Just two dead guys having fun in the desert.
No questions asked.
And he doesn't have that creepy woman chasing after him anymore, trying to get him.
But here are the wrinkles. I talked about wrinkles and twists at the beginning, and I quite liked the first 20, 25 minutes or so. I was on board. I liked the fact that Cruise was not the normal Cruise. He was a bit immoral and, you know, a little bit woo, a little bit wee, a little bit way. I liked the fact that he had a past with Annabelle Wallace that was alluded to, and obviously because he's a bit woo, he had dumped her and run off with the secret letter. I quite like that relationship. I like the fact that they killed Jake Johnson really early because he was really fucking annoying, and I was so upset when he came back. And a little twist, like with Courtney B. Vance comes into it and then gets killed, and then he doesn't come back. Why does he come back? Anyway, here's a question from Natasha Barden. Asks, why was a film about an ancient Egyptian tradition set in London? Well, because
we used to own Egypt. It was ours. We got all their stuff.
Yeah, we got all their stuff.
We took loads of their stuff. We took it away. We bought it back. We put it in a big museum and called it the British Museum, which doesn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then we said, oh, all right, have your country back, but we're not having your stuff back.
Yeah. I think because most of the other mummies are set in London, I think that's why. This one didn't feel like it had much of a link to previous mummies. People have pointed out...
Crossrail.
Crossrail.
It was linked via Crossrail.
Yes. The Crossrail sequence at the beginning. Told by the RPBBC man.
Yeah.
Love it.
People have pointed out that, I think, in Prodigium's lair, obviously we pointed out... I don't think it's an Easter egg if the camera zooms right in on it, but obviously we have the Gilman's hand. And we have a Dracula face, which is probably just a vampire, but, you know, it could be Dracula, you never know. But people have pointed out that apparently the Book of the Dead from the original, the Stephen Sommers mummy is in there as well. And so is this part of the same universe? I would say no. I would say it's just a gag, but you never know. If that means that John Hannah and Arnold Vosloo are going to turn up to save us from ourselves at any point, that would be great. Another question from Natasha Pardon. Why did they confusingly call Tom Cruise's character Nick and then cast Nick from New Girl as a sidekick? I don't know. Do people in the desert actually ride horses anymore? James, you've
been in the desert recently.
You've been in the desert.
Presumably quad bikes are less cinematic.
Presumably they are.
I rode horses in the desert in the 1990s. Maybe
this is a whole Dan origin story, isn't it, that we don't have time to get into. Dan rode horses in the desert in the 90s.
Around the pyramid, around the pyramids and everything. It's great.
Was it a caper? Did it involve Bedouins?
Did you discover buried treasure and then unleash a terrible curse upon you?
Well, there is a funny story about it, but I shouldn't tell it.
That's probably... In fact, you know what? I know this story and you definitely shouldn't tell it. Moving on.
Please tell it.
Nope.
Natasha Barton is continuing with the questions. It was good until they introduced a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, at which point I was like, really? This isn't a question, but it was really annoying and I felt I needed to tell someone this. Yeah, we haven't really talked about Jekyll and Hyde, really. So what do we make? You think he's one of the worst things in it, James?
Yes, I do.
As both Jekyll and Hyde?
Yes.
Okay, why do you think he's bad?
I think he's bad because it's incredibly forced. It's an unnecessary bridging device to try and tee us into other movies, and it pulled me out of the film. And also, we've already talked about the plot difficulties around him having the transformation, which, you know, if you have that kind of condition, you would take precautions. But they had to show that to sort of make it exciting. Oh, yes, I really want to see a film about this. But it just distracted from what was going on. And perhaps that was intentional, given that what was actually going on made no sense. But I didn't. It pulled me out of the main story and I found it an unwanted distraction. Also, because he was Basil Exposition for so much of the film, that irked me as well.
I quite like the fact that the Basil Exposition guy turned out to be Jekyll and Hyde. I just like you. What the hell? And also, I said this in the weekly podcast. I actually kind of got a bit of a buzz out of seeing Cruz and Crow kind of sharing a scene, and also in such a crazy film. You know, I just thought that was fun, and I thought Crow was clearly having fun.
But this is the thing that I should have expected more. You know, than actual subtlety, but. Jekyll and Hyde is one of the properties that they own that actually you could do something good with. You know, it can be subtly done, it can be carefully done, where you're not sure whether he's Jekyll or Hyde. You know, that Hyde is, you know, a careful, intelligent sociopath, more of a Dexter-type thing, as opposed to a physical monster. Mm. I mean, this was just League of Extraordinary Gentlemen without the CGI.
Well, I don't think they went far enough with Hyde.
Hyde, tone it down, don't ham it up.
Hyde is Jekyll, but grey and a bit feiny, and obviously born within the sound of the Bow Bells for reasons. But in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, a dreadful, dreadful film, but let's give it its due. When it went for Mr. Hyde, it really went for Mr. Hyde with this sort of misshapen, mutated giant monster with a huge arm. And it had Jason Fleming, and any film that has Jason Fleming is already onto a winner.
And I've got to pull you up on something, James. It was not CGI, and I'm sure Jason Fleming would love to tell you how not CGI that Mr. Hyde was.
Well, I apologise, but I would like to have seen it more sort of Aaron and Roy in Primal Fear, you know, that kind of personality switch, rather than... You know, I don't think you need evil black veins to hammer the point home.
Do you think that, you know, most people, right, going to this movie will know who Dracula is, they'll know who Frankenstein is, they'll know of the mummy. Will they know who Jekyll and Hyde are? Will they get that? Will they get that this guy, this erudite guy, is suddenly turning into a rager and... Will that completely baffle people?
They'll have seen the James Nesbitt TV show, so they'll be fine.
Youths, Dan. Youths.
But they don't know Jekyll and Hyde.
I don't think they do, mate.
That's why he talks like they do.
I'm very surprised. I mean, I'd say he's like core, you know.
Core youth.
Core mythos.
Yeah, okay.
For the universal monsteriness.
Really? I mean, Mummy, yes. Dracula, yes. Frankenstein, yes. But no, I would have thought Jekyll and Hyde's kind of peripheral, isn't he?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But here's the thing. Jekyll and Hyde, that is a phrase that is in the zeitgeist. Yeah. People say that. He had a Jekyll and Hyde personality. Maybe they don't really know what it's referring to, but...
And of course, everyone remembers Dr. Jekyll and Ms. Hyde.
Yeah. But this film doesn't take the time to explain. Like, he turns up going, hello, I'm Dr. Jekyll. And then, ooh, he suddenly starts convulsing and injecting himself with stuff. And if you didn't know what Jekyll and Hyde was, you'd be going, what the hell is going on here? Also, he disappears from the film.
Well, he's done his bit, isn't he?
Yeah. But, I mean, don't you think he would be of some use to the fight against Amunet?
Well, presumably he was recording his scenes for Bride of Frankenstein at that particular point, so...
What did Mimic make of the fight between him and Tom Cruise? Cruise, obviously, with his supernatural, unkillable powers versus, you know, Mr. Cockney wrestler bloke.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah?
I just liked it. I just liked the fact that it was a kind of a bit of a brutal scrap, sort of rolling around, scrabbling at each other, rather than being something, you know, gloriously choreographed or anything like that.
It was realistic in that it was the archetypal sort of workplace tussle.
Yeah.
You know, two men sort of like who aren't really used to fighting, sort of wrestling with each other and pushing each other over. And
yeah, I liked it. I liked it. It amused me.
James Corcoran asks via Twitter, it would have been great if Simon Pegg and Nick Frost had played Tom Cruise and his mate. It would have been great if Simon Pegg had been playing Tom Cruise. And Nick Frost have been playing Tom Cruise's mate.
Perhaps they can take up those roles in Brian of Frankenstein. Spiritual successor to Shaun of the Dead.
No, I've got it, I've got it. Peg and Frost can be Abbott and Costello.
There we go.
Done.
There we go. James Corcoran continues. He says it felt like they were caught between the Shaun of the Dead 5 versus a Tom Cruise generic action film and a creepy, genuinely creepy horror film. I thought there were some decent jump scares in this one, and then it forgot to be a horror film and just turned into a kind of subpar Raiders towards the end.
Yeah, but it wasn't really horror. You're right, though, there were a couple of jumps. I did make a little eep at one point during the film. Yeah. I forget which bit.
Because she's quite a freaky character. She's freakishly realised, I think, with the jerky movements, especially at the beginning when she's just come back from the dead and she's sucking Alan dry.
I thought she was very good.
I thought she was very good also.
Yeah.
I like Sophia Boutella a lot.
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of that stuff that you've just described was actually motion captured, not full-on effects. Mm-hmm. I think she would have done that. I think she's a very, very proficient physical performer.
Well, as we know, she's a very talented dancer.
Yeah.
You know, so she would have that in her. And Javier Botté, who played Mama in Mama, is also a very fine physical performer. He played Set.
Did he now?
No news on whether he played game or match. Game, set, and match joke there.
It's good.
Was that a sports joke?
Yeah. It was a sports joke.
Oh, right, okay, fine.
Joke.
Sorry, I don't understand football.
Sorry, making a racket. But there's also the Shaun of the Dead 5. I don't quite get that it's a Shaun of the Dead 5, but the film tries not to take itself seriously. There's a you know, the moment towards the end where he goes, "It's not me, it's you," which felt really totally misplaced. Yeah. But there's also little bits and back and forth. There's meant to be bantery repartee between Jekyll and Morton. What do we make of that?
I don't remember much repartee. It was just kind of like it was Crow's Jekyll kind of laying out the backstory to this whole universe. You know, sort of the dominoes are already falling, evil as disease. And all that kind of stuff.
Mm. Okay, fair enough. Ifan on Twitter asks, in regards to Mummy, do you think there's any scope for them to make the Dark Universe darker with a bit more Logan-esque maturity? Or will it be a series of bland, safe money spinners that everybody has seen 1,000 times before?
Hmm, let me think.
Well, actually, this is a 15 certificate, which is, relatively speaking, a bold move for a big blockbustery franchisey starter.
Why do you think it was a 15? I can't think of anything particularly.
Well, it's quite sexy near the start, wasn't
Not
it? There was
really.
Some sort of sexiness.
There is a bit of sexiness.
There's definitely bottom and side.
There is some bottom, yes. I didn't realise bottom was criteria for 15 these days, but sure.
Did we see the arse of Cruise?
I think we did. And also he was cupping himself, wasn't he?
We saw the cup. Yes,
yeah, he was.
But Chris Pine's
cup runneth over.
Chris Pine cupped himself in Wonder Woman, and that wasn't a 15.
We think it was the bottom.
We didn't see him from behind.
Also, I think there was some intense horror and blah blah blah.
Yeah,
but
I'd love to read the BBFC note for this. Contains zombie side boob
and genital cupping. Now, is Cruise a one-hander or a two-hander? Because Chris Pine, and this surprised me, in Wonder Woman, is a one-hand cupper. Now, I'm not denigrating Chris Pine's genitalia because I haven't seen it, because he was holding it with his hand, and obviously I was looking elsewhere. Mm. But, I mean, that's not great if you can cup yourself with one hand, is it?
Yeah, but he probably had shrinkage.
He had been in a pool.
He'd just been in a cold bath.
Yeah. 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 Okay.
In answer to your question, I don't remember what Tom Cruise was doing, but he was in the morgue, which I believe is refrigerated, so it could be excused.
It could be a one-cupper. But he looks bloody good, doesn't he?
Who?
What, naked?
Cruise
or Pine?
Crew, both. But Crew is genuinely, I mean, my God, he's nearly 70. And look at him. He's got pecs and he's got the other thing. What do they call the things? The bulge on the side of your neck.
Trapezius maximus.
That's the one. He's got those as well. And it's like, wow.
Yeah.
Owl with, what the hell is this? Owl with envelope on Twitter asks, CGI was fantastic. What was your favorite effect?
I don't know.
I don't think this is a CGI effect, but I genuinely really liked the plane crash.
Yeah. Yeah, that was well done. I also enjoyed the rats. Not that the rats look good, but I quite liked that sequence where he's sort of trapped in the alleyway and the kind of rats come at him and then you've got the sort of zombified form creeping towards him. That was quite good. I don't think the CGI was anything to write home about, but yeah, fine.
Yeah, I was more, as I say, I was more impressed with the kind of the physical stuff, like Butella's performance and everything. I am curious, though. I mean, that whole plane crash sequence, I mean, people have said it looks like something from a Mission Impossible film, right? And Christopher McQuarrie's got a script credit, right? I'm just curious, did they just, like, take an action sequence from what was going to be in a Mission Impossible film that Chris McQuarrie had come up with and put it in this film?
Genuinely,
and that's why he's got the credit?
Wouldn't surprise me.
No.
Okay, thank you.
just hearing when...
It's just one of those things that's been bouncing around my mind since I've seen
Maybe
it.
You said that, but when we had Chris on the podcast, like, and he talked in great detail about some of the great like ideas that they come up with, and they often start with a set piece and kind of hang things off it. So you've got to wonder how many of these great set pieces are just lying around his bedroom on notepads. And perhaps he just took one, you know, ironed it out and just said, you know, cross out Ethan Hunt, put in Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
But no, I
can see where you're coming from. I suspect that Chris McQuarrie would rather save a kick-ass set piece for the movie he will write and direct for a different studio rather than give it to the Mummy. And also, Ethan Hunt would die at the end of that plane sequence. So maybe. It's a really fun sequence. I think some of the other action sequences in this movie are a little bit flat, a little bit lacking in inspiration. Nick Dissembly and not Nick Morton, after we saw the film, said, how do you make a scene in which our hero is being chased underwater by a bunch of crusader mummies? How do you make that boring? And it's a very, very good point. It was quite dull.
It wasn't boring. I really love that scene.
But that's got everything you love. Yeah. Water, Tom Cruise, Crusader mummies.
Oh, people in chainmail.
People in chainmail. You love
just
it.
Just instantly love everything if it's got chainmail in it.
Yeah.
I don't know, marauding zombies have lost some of their... I mean, after you've seen the sort of 1,000th episode of The Walking Dead, do you know what I mean? It's hard to feel for the sort of the mummy zombies, which seem like a poor imitation.
This was better than The Walking Dead for one good reason.
Go on.
This didn't have Negan in it.
Well, yes, that is.
This didn't have a boring man in a leather jacket.
Leave Negan alone.
Okay, we'll wrap it up in a few seconds. Tom Moran asks, why didn't the captain dude, good old Courtney B. Vance, send more people down into the hull rather than the two known treasure thieves and the archaeologists?
Yeah, it wasn't what I would call a great moment of judgment there.
Ellen Case, 47, asks, is it okay to enjoy a film that is still messy and has a bad female character? Do you mean, well, I'm talking to my Twitter page. To Ellen, do you mean bad female character as in badly drawn, or do you mean bad as in Aminette is bad? I would say yes, it is absolutely fine to enjoy films that have female bad guys. Otherwise, we wouldn't enjoy things like, spoiler alert, Gone Girl.
Although the violence at the end when he kills her made me feel slightly uncomfortable.
Well, that's because the set, it is a bit weird. You've got this whole idea that she's kind of obsessed with him and she just wants to get this man and she needs to get this, and then she gets him and then he finally defeats her by sort of beating, and the way she curls up into the fetal position, which I believe is a kind of, because actually you often find death bodies like that, mummified bodies in that position. But there was something about the ways, like, that sort of, she's protecting herself and...
It had a domestic violence vibe that really didn't sit well with me.
Yeah, I did get a little bit uncomfortable, but then I thought it was maybe me just being, you know...
No, I'm
such a sensitive person.
That bugged me.
And, I think it's bugged a few people, actually, which is interesting. But as we said, Sofia Boutella is very, very good in the role. I don't think that she's that evil, Aminette. Be honest, is she? Really?
She killed a baby at the beginning of the
film. Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
She's pretty evil.
That's a good point.
I'm into moral relativity, but I think baby killing is not a good thing to do.
You're right, Dan. The Empire podcast does not condone baby killing. That's absolutely make sure that people understand that. Craig Garvey, Yell at the Abyss, asks, do you think, and this is a very good pertinent question, I think, do you think people would have been more forgiving of this movie if it hadn't been pushed so much as the start of an extended universe?
Yeah, is the short answer. I think James's rant slash monologue towards the beginning of this little discussion was, I think, quite fair. But I think that's going to be in a lot of people's minds. I think people like to sort of, you know, if they detect... I mean, the thing is, let's be honest, right? Movies exist to make money, primarily. It's a business.
What?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they want to make... You know, they want to make things that are successful that more people come and see, and then they want to come and see more things. But when that becomes too obvious, people get annoyed. Mm-hmm. It takes them out of it because they don't like to think about that reality.
Well, I think also there's an element of running before you can walk that I don't think Marvel, for example, necessarily did. I mean, they said from the off that they were building towards the Avengers, and that got people excited. But it doesn't really... It's saying that they're building towards whatever they're building towards with this. A team-up movie where they all fight Steve Bannon. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen with this franchise, but it doesn't seem to have got people excited.
I think there's a hubris to this that just rankles. And it's just, and as I said, a cynicism to it. And it feels like everyone just wants a piece of the Marvel formula. And it's just, do something different. Do something original. Go out on your own.
But I agree. I agree with Craig Garvey. I think if he'd gone into this movie, not knowing that he had plans to do something else, and then, you know, Russell Crowe turns up as Jekyll, you go, oh, that's funny. That's a good idea. That's really, really interesting. And then the movie comes out and you go, oh, wow. And then they announce it and you go, oh, this is interesting. Now I'm intrigued. Now I want to see Javier Bardem with the Boris Karloff, because this is the thing, Universal hold the IP to that version of the Frankenstein monster. So, you know, we're going to get the flat skull and the bolts coming out of the neck, presumably. I'm guessing we would. Otherwise, what's the point of holding that copyright? Then I'd get excited. But at the moment, we're all a little bit deflated. But, you know, the last time we saw all these monsters together was the Monster Squad. And that was belting. So I want to see more like that.
Was that the last time?
That wasn't the last time.
Well, all of them
Van
together.
Helsing.
Van Helsing didn't have Creature from the Black Lagoon or...
Had a few of them, didn't he?
Yeah.
He had quite a few. Penny Dreadful.
Mummy. Penny Dreadful. Also good. And we won't mention The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Yes. A film so catastrophic, both its director and star retired. And that was 14 years ago. That's an interesting one, my word. All right, okay, we have exhausted the questions, and I believe we've exhausted our sanity with this. Thank you so much for listening. Also out at the moment in terms of spoiler specials, Wonder Woman, if you want to listen to that. Our next spoiler special is going to be Baby Driver with Edgar Wright. It's going to be a lot of fun. Do listen to the regular podcast every Friday if you don't already. Do subscribe again if you don't already. We would really appreciate that. In the meantime, thank you for listening to our spoiler special for The Mummy. You were listening, of course, earlier to Alex Kurtzman and Helen O'Hara. You've been listening to James Dyer.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Dan Jolin.
Farewell, Chris.
And you've been listening to Chris Hewitt. I am off to inject myself because I feel the change coming on. But then again, I am in my 40s. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye.